This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
In a powerful act of resistance, Iranian women are risking their lives by burning their headscarves and protesting against the government. But what sparked these protests in the first place, and what can they accomplish? I'm Darshan Johan, and this is Today I Learned. On the show with me today is Asal Rad. She's the research director at the National Iranian American Council and also the author of State of Resistance, Politics, Culture and Identity in Modern Iran. Welcome to the show, Asal. Let's start from the beginning. On the 13th of September, the Iranian so-called morality police captured a Kurdish girl named Mahsa Amini. Why did she get arrested and what happened next?
Thanks for having me. Well, we call it the so-called morality police because that's the name they go by themselves. But of course, the idea of having a police titled with morality is absurd itself. And what they mostly do is enforce the Iranian dress codes that affect both men and women, but much more women than men, in the sense that women's dress code is much more strict. Their figures can't be showing, so usually they wear some kind of longer coat or light coat, something like that, on top, and then they have to wear a headscarf covering their hair. That restriction throughout the decades since the revolution, when it was first imposed, has gone through, you know, different sort of levels of enforcement. And so a lot of Iranian women, especially young women, wear their hijab very loosely. And so Mahsa Amini, a Kurdish-Iranian woman who was visiting Tehran, was stopped by these police and for her inappropriate hijab. Eyewitnesses on the scene said that they saw her being beaten in the police van. And of course, as for those of us who know the story, she was soon after being detained, she was hospitalized in a coma, and she was announced dead the following day. Right. And this is what sparked just widespread protests across the entire country, because of, you know, because Mahsa could have been anyone. So Mahsa Amini, her Kurdish name is Jina. Mm-hmm. This could have been any young woman in Iran because of the fact that most young women wear their headscarf loosely. And so this new administration, the Raisi administration, which has tried to increase across the spectrum, by the way, not just on women's attire, but just increasing repression and the severity of laws and the imposition of laws, how strict they are, trying to tighten the restrictions on attire and enforce them, has created, you know, in part this atmosphere that allows this young girl not only to be detained, but to be violently beaten to the point of causing her death. So she was killed by the, you know, so-called morality police. And that killing is what sparked these protests that go much deeper. And I know we'll get into that more.
Right. Now, just to clarify, Asal, what exactly is the morality police? Are they actually a uniformed body with police powers tasked to monitor if people are following religious dress codes and whatnot?
Yeah, they're a uniformed body. They have their own sort of like independent, I mean, they have their own vans, for instance, that say Gashta Irshad on the side, which is morality police. They don't have the same, you know, it's odd because it doesn't translate well to a lot of other states that don't have this kind of institution as part of their police system. But for instance, they don't have jurisdiction over other types of laws or restrictions or things like that. In the same way that you might have, you know, like traffic police, as silly as it is to compare them, because obviously they're not comparable. But in the same way that you might have traffic police that exclusively police one sort of area and have jurisdiction over one piece of the law. In that sense, the morality police are there to enforce these guidelines, especially on attire. I mean, from most of what I have seen and experienced, it is especially women's attire that they police.
So just like you said, the death of Mahsa Amini sparked protests and resistance in major cities across the country. Who is leading the charge and what exactly are the protests about? What are the demands?
So there's different, you know, like I said, because this is the event that sparked them, at the heart of these protests are women. This is women-led protests. It's one of the reasons why, you know, we've seen casualties that are women, casualties because security forces, Iranian security forces have yet again, and this is a pattern, met protests with deadly force.
Right.
And so not only is it women-led, but it is to a large extent youth-led. And the continuation of the protests that we're seeing from what started 2 weeks ago into what's going on today, you see universities, students at universities protesting, students in grade school, in high school protesting. So, and girls, young girls taking off their hijab that are supposed, that's part of their, you know, school uniform typically right. when they go. So there's a strong youth element, and there's this, you know, women are leading these protests, but they go deeper than just the hijab. They go deeper than the hijab. They go deeper than women's rights. While those are at the core, what these protests show are much more deep grievances held across the spectrum of Iranian society. And that's why you also see, you know, you see a spectrum of people across the board in terms of age, across geographically, across the country. All provinces have had demonstrations. Whereas in 2019, you had more working and poorer class Iranians participating in those protests. You have the middle class that's again joined protests. So you have more classes coming in to join in protests. So it really shows how deep the grievances of that society go towards their, you know, towards Iranian authorities, towards the Islamic Republic, towards the system as a whole. And I think that's encapsulated most in the fact that they continuously chant death to the dictator or death to Khamenei. They're going at the very core of the system when they talk about the supreme leader.
Does this protest stem from this particular cruel, tragic incident, or has the anger been building up for some time already?
You know, it depends on how far back you want to go, really. Mm-hmm. It certainly is something that goes, it's, you know, things that's built over time.
Right.
It's anger that's built over time. That's why there's this sort of feeling of enough is enough. You know, there's only so much that that any society, that Iranians themselves can take before this boils over. And you see how it's spilling out right now across the country. Like I just mentioned, there were protests in November of 2019. There were protests at the end of 2017 and into the early stages of 2018. There were protests in early 2020 after, you know, initially there was an outpouring after the U.S. assassination of Qasem Soleimani, but then after Iran shot down a civilian Ukrainian flight that killed everybody on board, you saw protests again. And mm-hmm. one of the reasons why protests, not only in Iran, but in multiple places in the world where there were large protest movements going on, died down was the pandemic, right? The fact that we had to quarantine, the fact that you couldn't gather in large crowds, that people were getting sick, that people were dying, that really doesn't lend itself to large scale, you know, social movements out on the streets.
Right.
And all of this, you know, you can trace back to 2009 when there were protests in large scale protests in Iran after the contested election. 1999, there were protests in Iran. And this, in my view, if you really want to contextualize what Iranians are calling for, they're calling for freedom. They're calling for a system that serves its people. And that call goes back more than a century. All right. Iranians have been calling for such a system, starting from even maybe before the Constitutional Revolution of 1905. But there are these moments in its history, these watershed moments that have had a great impact on that society, and there have been turning points. And so where in 1905, in the Constitutional Revolution, you have the establishment of a constitution, right? This notion, the idea, a consciousness within the society that they should have a constitutional government, it fails at toppling the monarchy at the time. In 1979, right. the monarchy is toppled, but then you have, you know, a dictatorship replaced with another form of tyranny in the Islamic Republic. Which not only limits political freedoms, but on top of that has all these limitations that are in social freedoms, which is part of what we're seeing pour out today. So I think that there's a very long history behind what we're seeing. But specifically, if you look at this generation, who are the people who are protesting? Who are the people who are leading the protests in many ways? And when you look at the fact that they're very young, right? These are people in their late teens, early 20s. Mm-hmm. They didn't live through the revolution. They didn't live through the war of the 1980s, the Iran-Iraq war. And so their world and their view is removed from that sort of that era and that time. And really, and this is a generation that's grown up with the internet, with right. social media. And so they're simply demanding their freedom. It's not that complicated in the sense that what they're demanding is freedom. And the system that exists does not allow those freedoms. And so that's why it goes to the core of it.
And how has the Iranian dictatorship and its authorities responded to these protests and their call for freedom?
The state has responded the way that it itself, like most authoritarian states have responded, and the Iranian state itself has responded. The Islamic Republic has responded before. It's crushed protests, right? That's the attempt. Rather than actually listening to what people are saying, rather than heeding their calls, rather than considering the fact that arguably the majority of the country does not agree with this system and wants their freedoms, especially the young people. I mean, Iran is a country that has, I think it's about 40% of the population is under 24 years old. That's a huge youth population. Right. And there's a huge gap between the people who are in power. I think the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei is somewhere in his 80s, like 83 years old, and 18-year-olds who feel very differently about what their future should look like. So the state has imposed mass arrests. I mean, you have just anyone doing anything, any form of dissent. I mean, there is this song that sort of exploded on the scene by Shervin Hajipour, who, you know, all he did is sing a song. And the song was composed of tweets that Iranians had shared about the spirit of these protests. And he was arrested for singing a song. Women are being arrested who are defying the dress code and going out with their hijab. They're being arrested. Student activists that have been active in the past are being arrested. Journalists are being arrested. I mean, you have arrests across the board. We saw yesterday just horrifying scenes from Sharif University, where, you know, security forces basically besieged the entire campus, surrounded it. And you see videos of students running away with their backpacks on. I mean, it is a large-scale crackdown that has caused, from what we obviously, because the state has tried to cut off the internet, cut off communications, which is another pattern of repressing protests, is cutting them off from the world. The death toll is likely much higher than what we know. I think Amnesty International has a death toll of 52. Another Iranian human rights group that's based in Norway has the number at 133. And the numbers are much likely higher than any of that. So they are cracking down with brutal repression, as we have seen in the past.
Right. And has this crackdown and this repressive show of force slowed down the protests, or has it only angered Iranian people even more?
It doesn't seem to be slowing them down in the sense that I would agree with your second point. I think if anything, the sheer brutality, the way that they are going after anyone, I mean, athletes that have spoken out have been arrested. Celebrities that have spoken out have been arrested. So the way that they're trying to suppress this protest, this movement, I think is strengthening the result, especially of the youth, who we see despite this, right? This has now been going on for over 2 weeks, despite mass arrests, despite being met with deadly force, despite all of that, all of the violence that's being carried out, they're still out there protesting. Students are still showing up today to school girls are showing up without their headscarves on, without their hijab. They're still protesting at universities. Even if the state is able to crush protests in the same way that it has in the past,
right. It
cannot crush a movement. It cannot stop a generation that is demanding freedoms.
Absolutely. On the show with me today is Asal Rad, Research Director at the National Iranian American Council. After the break, we discuss if these protests could overthrow the Iranian government. Keep it here on Today I Learned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Today I Learned. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Asal Rad, Research Director at the National Iranian American Council and the author of State of Resistance, Politics, Culture and Identity in Modern Iran. And she's giving me the 101 on the protests happening across Iran. So, Asal, I want to talk to you specifically about the headscarves, right? Because the Iranian women are in a show of resistance to protest. They are burning their headscarves. They are removing their headscarves. They are not wearing headscarves in public spaces, which they are supposed to, according to the morality police and the law. But just to be clear, this is not an anti-hijab protest, nor is it an anti-Muslim protest, right?
No, I wouldn't characterize it that way at all. Mm-hmm. It's anti-compulsory hijab. It's mm-hmm. it's anti-mandatory hijab. It is a protest where, you know, one of the central slogans that have been used is women, life, freedom.
Right.
You see crowds of students chanting simply freedom. So at the core of this is freedom. And that's why, you know, again, this is coupled with and there's a lot of different slogans that have been used, but these are the central ones, right? The ones that we've heard the most. And when you hear death to the dictator, the reason ultimately is because that system of authoritarianism is what precludes their freedoms. So this isn't, we haven't heard any, or I haven't, I should say at least, heard any slogans that indicate that this is an anti-religious or anti-Islam or, you know, anti-hijab for instance, for the pendulum to swing in the other direction where they think that no one should be allowed to wear a hijab. And in fact, we have seen women who wear the more traditional chador, women who choose to wear the hijab, who have come out in support of protesters, who have come out in support of their freedom to wear what they want to wear. So this isn't necessarily an attack on the religion, but it is an attack on the religion being used by an authoritarian state to restrict the freedoms of its people.
So we could do a whole separate podcast on the 1979 Iranian Revolution. But for the purpose of this discussion, right, Asal, are there any parallels you see between what happened in 1979 and what's happening today? Because what I find very interesting is that the hijab was also used as a symbol of resistance back in 1979, but in a completely different way, right?
Right. So that sort of shows you, and we don't even have to go back to 1979 Iran. I mean, even right now you have places in which the freedom to wear the hijab or Islamophobia or any of these things affect the society in a way where the hijab becomes a symbol of resistance.
Right.
Which is why, you know, as a, you know, Iranians have their own sort of battle, what they're fighting for. But as a society, we should be fighting for freedom for women to choose, right? Freedom mm-hmm. is in choice. So if they choose to wear a hijab, that should be allowed. And if they choose not to, that should be allowed. But in terms of parallels to the 1979 revolution, you know, it's hard to, I don't like to make predictions on where we're going to go. As a historian, we try not to make predictions. We try to look at the past to understand the present, but not to sort of predict what direction we're going in.
Right.
Of course, what these protests are calling for is revolutionary, right? It's revolutionary in the sense that it would for a country in which for 40 odd years, these restrictions have been imposed on half of the population. If those restrictions were lifted, that is revolutionary. That is a fundamental change, especially because the state uses the veil as such a symbol. You know, very clearly, a full-scale revolution would be toppling the supreme leadership.
Right.
So Iran, after the 1979 revolution, in its initial stages in the post-revolution, the constitution was very similar to that of like the French Fifth Republic. You know, you had the separation of powers, different branches of government, the notion of elections, all of these things were built into that system. But what happens throughout the year of 1979, before the constitution is actually ratified by the end of the year, is this authoritarian system, Velayat-e-Faqih, the system of jurisprudence, that comes on sort of like is overlaid on top of what is a democratic apparatus. So you have an Iranian civil society, but that Iranian civil society is constantly restricted by the undemocratic processes of an unelected body. And so, yeah, if you were to topple that part of the system, that would be a full-scale revolution. And that could help bring about actual democracy in Iran, which has never existed, which, you know, has had there's been movements for democratization, right? So the period of 1941 to 1953 before the US-UK coup that ousted popular Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, that was a period of democratization where they tried to use these branches of government, this idea of constitutionalism that had been established in 1905 with the Constitutional Revolution. So it's not just one parallel, but you can take pieces from this long history to sort of understand where they are at right now. What is quite different right now is this is, so far at least, this is a leaderless movement,
right?
It is a movement led by not a woman, but women in Iran. It is a movement led by not one youth, but youth in Iran. And so if that changes, if a leader arises from it, then, you know, we might have specific parallels. Which we've already seen, teachers talking about going on strikes. If other aspects of the labor movement join in and you have strikes and boycotts, then you'll have more parallels to 1979 as well. But something for people to keep in mind is 1979 was not something that happened overnight. I mean, arguably, from a historical perspective, it was decades in the making. So, you know, where this particular set of protests will lead, we're not sure. But I don't think that there is a way to go back to the way that things were. I think that when we look at this moment historically in the future, this will be another watershed moment in Iranian history that changes something. What that change will entail, though, we don't know yet.
Would you say that the fact that there isn't a leader leading the process, leading the protest right now, how do you sort of look at that aspect of it? Because it is, you know, on the one hand, very inspiring, and it's a very powerful thing that we are witnessing right now, a very powerful moment in history where this protest, you know, it wasn't led by a particular individual or what, it was, you know, the collective anger of society, and they took it to the streets. But without sort of a leader leading the protest towards a particular political direction, there is a question of what could happen next, right? You take it to the streets in an act of resistance, but what happens next? How are you looking at this, the fact that there isn't a particular leader pushing the protest necessarily towards a certain political direction?
I think one of the things we have to keep in mind is that there's no leader because this wasn't... Well, the protests are organic, right? The protests were sparked by an event in Iran, a horrible, you know, horrifying event that has galvanized people really to go to the streets and protest. They weren't organized before that, so there was that factor.
Right.
But over the period, right, we've only been seeing this happening for about two weeks.
Yes.
And so, you know, even again, if you want to actually parallel to 1979, the sort of spark that occurred then started in early 1978. And then it took almost a full year until you saw the revolution. Of course, there were political parties. There were different political factions and organizations that were in the country that had been moving towards, you know, wanting to topple the monarchy for decades. And so those parties came together with the one objective of toppling the monarchy, which was problematic for its own reasons, right? When you have these groups that don't necessarily agree on a vision for the future, but only agree in the sense that they want to topple the current form of government,
right?
Then in a post-revolutionary society, you also then see the infighting and eventually a lot of political maneuvering, which in the case of Iran, the Islamic Republic Party is the one who basically prevails. They beat out the other factions and they don't do it through peaceful means. They beat out other factions through political maneuvering and then through purges, through actually, you know, through fighting between these parties. And even members of the Islamic Republic Party initially after the revolution die as well because there is so much infighting. So there doesn't seem to be that same kind of dynamic in this situation. But there are people who have been, whether they're activists, whether they were former politicians, whether they are journalists. I mean, across Iranian civil society, there are people who have been actively engaged in their political situation in their country's politics, and they've been engaged in different ways. They've been engaged by voting. They've been engaged by choosing not to vote. They've been engaged through protests. They've been engaged through strikes, if you look at the labor movement. So if those different groups can come together and sort of have a picture of what they want, what exactly their demands are, then again, we might see something more, a clearer picture of where it's headed. As of now, though, to your point, I think it is inspiring to see that something is leaderless, because sometimes, you know, the cult of the leader, the cult of personality that's around an individual can take away from that experience of the masses. But you know, right now you have this large section of Iranian society that wants to see fundamental change. And while I think eventually there has to be some kind of organized leadership from within the country, if indeed they want an alternative, that's something that will take time likely to unfold.
Before we wrap this conversation up, Asal, how can we show solidarity with Iranian women? I'm talking about the international community, you know, people outside of Iran. How can we show solidarity with Iranian women and the Iranian society as a whole right now?
What I keep hearing, and what a lot of people that I know who have family and friends on the ground in Iran who are participating in these protests, what we hear is keep telling the stories. Don't let it go away. Don't let the news cycle just take it away. Keep sharing them. Be their voices. So the number one way to show solidarity is simply to share their stories, to make sure that we're still talking about this. But also in some cases, to not undermine the protests, right? And that can come from different sides of the sort of political equation that exists outside of the country. So I've been critical of people on the left who try to echo the talking points of the Iranian government by saying that these aren't protests, these are riots, and it's from the outside. That's not true. These are organic protests. These people have legitimate grievances, and it shouldn't be difficult to simply support them and acknowledge that fact.
Right.
On the more hawkish voices on the right, to use these protests as a way to capitalize on hawkish policies that have long hurt the Iranian civilian population anyways, is also problematic, right? So it's a question of listening to the voices inside of the country, letting them tell their own story, and helping them tell their story by using our platforms to share their stories. And so I think those are the sort of pillars of solidarity. Besides that, I mean, I'm speaking as an Iranian American, someone who's in the US. So, you know, where the US is concerned, where we have a lot of sanctions on Iran, some of those sanctions work to harm civilians.
Right.
In what sense? One of the examples is internet freedoms, right? The Iranian government has tried to restrict and censor the internet for years. And you see that in protests, they try to cut access to the internet. There are certain platforms that Iranians do not have access to, not because of the Iranian side, but because of sanctions on the US side. So I was happy to see, and our organization was part of the groups that worked on this to push the Biden administration to update General License D1 so that US policies were not inadvertently helping the Iranian government censor the internet, you know, or not allowing access. So there are concrete actions that we can take as well, making sure that our politicians and our media are covering these stories. All of that, I think, is a way of showing solidarity to Iranians.
And on that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Asal.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Asal Rad. She's a research director at the National Iranian American Council and the author of State of Resistance, Politics, Culture and Identity in Modern Iran. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can also check us out on podcasts. We're available on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Today I Learned, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.